Welcome to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Now, your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan.
Well, Mike Brennan, anyway, Matt, is his employer, I don't understand this, demanded that he actually be at the Lawrence Tech golf outing today since he is the director of communications. Ring that bell. He will not be with us, so you're stuck with me, but I think I can handle it. We have a really full show today. We have on the line, standing by from Grand Rapids, Norbert Kugela, who is a partner with Warner, Norcross, and Judd. And he's going to be talking about a topic. To tell you the truth, I wasn't really sure what it was until they kind of explained it to me. Geofencing, a technique for human resources recruitment, which automatically collects data from users' cell phones and within a specific region for the purpose of targeted advertising. But in this case, there's other things that go on with that. Isn't that right, Norbert?
There's a few things going on. So we're going to talk about some of the privacy issues associated with that, that strategy.
Okay, so let's start off with let's go into that. We just described geofencing, but why is it so attractive for human resources recruiters?
When you're trying to advertise online, right, it is always the question about who are you reaching, right? Where are these people located? So, you know, what geofencing does, it's a technique that can zone in on people in a particular geographic location, based on the location of their cell phone or other mobile device. You can tell, geographically where this person is. And so it enables you to, target your advertising to people in a certain specific locale. It's been used for by advertisers for a while, but we're starting to see companies use it also to target people for recruitment. If you have an open job, especially one that requires a certain skill set, you can use this technique to maybe target people who maybe work at a competitor's location or in a particular city where you're looking to, recruit people and, target an advertisement to them directly. So you can get, more bang for your buck, with your recruiting and maybe also, target in on people with the specific skill set that you need. Sometimes you combine this with your own research so that maybe you can compile, maybe you buy a list, so to speak, of potential candidates that you want to target. Maybe you can buy it from some kind of online service, or maybe you can even coordinate with like a college or university, right, with people who are graduating with a certain skill set. And when, some of those people enter into a geographic location that you think might make them, receptive to the idea of working for you, you can have, the ad delivered to them. And if all goes well, they may respond and you may end up, with a highly qualified person to fill that open position for you.
Okay. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
All right. So why does geofencing raise privacy concerns?
Yeah. Well, at the end of the day, it's going to rely on some kind of identifiable information about the individual, right? Geographic location and probably name information and whatnot. If you're relying on a service to do this, and you probably are, they may be collecting quite a bit of information about the individual, engaging in some kind of profiling of the individual to let you know that this is perhaps a suitable target for you. So, at the very least, I think you've got a contractual issue. Does the company that you're relying on to help you, do this geofencing, do they have the permission to collect this information and share it with you? Right? That's something that you need to address in the contract with them. Now, if you yourself, if your own company is collecting personally identifiable information in connection with this, then you also have to worry about the data that you collect and, you know, make sure that you're safeguarding it appropriately, you know, from hackers or, you know, even your own people misusing the information for some reason.
Okay, so if a company is collecting personally identifiable information, what should it do to ensure that it is adequately protecting that information?
Yeah, well, you know, I'd say you know, what you do in this case is probably no different than you would do with other personally identifiable information. But, you know, you basically want to make sure that, first of all, you think about what you are collecting. Do you really need all of it, right? One of the first strategies, you know, to minimize your risk is to limit the amount of personally identifiable information that you actually collect. Then you also want to think about, you know, who has access to it or who needs access to it, right? And limit access to just those people who need to use the information. I would say also think about how long you retain the information, right? You know, at some point it goes stale anyway, but the shorter amount of time that you retain the information, the shorter the risk, you know, that particular information will be misused, you know, or breached in some way. Then, of course, you know, you've got to look at the security on your system to make sure that it's adequate, you know, and there's a whole slew of things there. And I'm not an expert necessarily on system security, but, you know, think about, you know, passwords and strong passwords and things like that, you know, and segmenting your network and monitoring network activity, you know, all of those kinds of things. Of course, keeping your software up to date, applying patches, those things. And to the extent that you're relying on third parties to store this information for you, or, you know, you've given them access to the information, make sure you've got contracts with those third parties to, you know, to make sure that they have adequate security on the information as well. You know, but at the end of the day, it's usually a matter of risk management, right? Doing risk assessments on your system and making sure that you understand the vulnerabilities and you're addressing those in some way.
Okay. Does it matter where the people who data collect live or work? Does that matter at all?
Yeah, it can. You know, here in the United States, you know, each state has its own laws on the books about breach notifications and what's considered sensitive data that requires notification. And I'll tell you that the trend has been for these laws to expand in scope as to what is considered to be sensitive information. You know, and if you're looking at, you know, targeting people who live outside of the United States, it gets even more complicated because you have to consider those laws. And some of those laws even have you know, restrictions on cross-border transfers. There's restrictions on how the data can be used, what you can do with it. There's even data localization laws in place, you know, that may require you to store the data in, you know, the countries where these people live rather than transported here to the United States. So you definitely need to take into keep in mind, I guess, where people live and work.
Okay. Are there types of information that companies should not store?
You know, I wouldn't say that there's necessarily a prohibition on storing, you know, any particular type of information. But what I'd say is, you know, that the more information you store and the more sensitive the information is that you store, you know, there's probably greater obligations to protect it. You know, obviously, if we're talking like financial information about people or health information, there may be, you know, specific laws that come into play. But even if you don't have those kinds of things, I think, you know, if you're building profiles about people, the more thorough those profiles become, the more detailed they are, you know, the greater risk that will be attractive to hackers who might want to exploit that information for some kind of a fraud scheme or something. So, you know, the more information you have, you know, the riskier it is and the greater steps you need to take to protect it.
How long should companies store personally identifiable information?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think a lot of people just want to keep information forever, but that's usually not a good idea. You know, what you really need to do is you need to think, first of all, you know, what is your business need for this information? You know, like how long is it really practical for you to use it? You also need to think about, you know, the regulations that might be out there, you know, that might limit the amount of time you can retain the information. I'd say that's probably more true in other countries than the United States. But even here, you know, there may be some limits depending on the information that you're storing. And then just think about, you know, how long is the data relevant? You know, people, you know, if you're collecting data for a recruiting campaign, you know, people will move, people will change jobs. You know, it's only going to be relevant for a certain amount of time. So I would imagine that the amount of time that you really should be keeping this kind of information is probably relatively short.
Any kind of guideline on that? 3 months, 6 months?
I guess you'd have to think about, you know, how, you know, what the proper amount of time is. But I think it's probably in that time frame. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about what you do with Warner, Norcross, and Judd. Now, I know we had some other folks on the show last month that were part of the new Emerging Media Group. I'm not sure. Are you part of that group?
I'm not actually part of that group, but I do work with a lot of those same people. I'm co-chair of our privacy and information security team here at Warner. So I deal a lot with, you know, the privacy issues and security information issues. A lot of work in the breach area. I do a lot of work involving HIPAA, medical information, you know, and breach responses, things like that.
Okay, and how would all the things that you're doing, how would geofencing rank in that criteria? Is it one of the top issues or sort of a middle issue or what?
Well, you know, it's I wouldn't say that I've done a lot of work in this area, but you know, it's really kind of it uses the same privacy issues that we deal with, you know, when we're dealing with any of these types of things. You know, there's some basic privacy practices that you want to deal with, you know, when you're talking about personally identifiable information, and geofencing, you know, falls squarely in that area.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it at that. Norbert Kugler with Warner, Norcross, and Judd. Do you want to provide any information if folks want to contact you for more information?
My direct dial number is 616-752-2186, and my email address is nkugele@wnj.com.
And this is Mike Brennan. You've been listening to a segment on M Squared TechCast on the Podcast Detroit Network. Mike Brennan flying solo today. Matt's out playing golf at the Lawrence Technological University. There we go. Golf outing. He actually had to work, so I guess we let him off this week, but we're going to punish him, have him in next week. So anyway, we have one of our recurring guests with us, Tanya Matthews, the CEO and Was it Chief Innovation Officer? Is that what you call him?
I think last time I got to be the Chief Curiosity Officer.
Okay, I knew it was one of those. Yeah. With the Michigan Science Center, which is in downtown Detroit, right by State there. Mm-hmm. And, gosh, I have a really long list of stuff here from her staff. They never provide – I always know your staff is going to provide me with a lot of material to work with.
A lot of stuff. Absolutely.
Yes. So, anyway, let's start off with actually, I'm going to skip down the list because everybody knows this eclipse is coming up.
Yeah.
And you guys are going to – we should give the date. That's going to be August
21st. August 21st. It is a Monday. Yes.
Monday
the August 21st is the total solar eclipse over the contiguous United States.
Unfortunately, Michigan is not part of that. But
we are not. But, you know, we'll actually have about 80 to 85% totality.
Okay.
So it is enough to start some apocalyptic rumors if you weren't actually paying attention to this podcast.
Yes.
So the sky will go a bit dark. So we're really excited about that. The last one, the last solar eclipse over the United States was in 1979. So it's been a while. But the next one is in 2024. So it's coming up. And actually, Detroit might be even a bit closer to totality than we will be this time. So it'd be very cool.
Yeah, I picked a bad time to go to Europe. I'll be in Europe on August 21st. So we won't be seeing it there. But hopefully we'll see other fun things in Amsterdam, right?
Yes, I think you will definitely see other fun things in Amsterdam, or you can connect to us and through us. One of the things we'll be doing that day, so it's kind of a eclipse party, sort of the whole day. Of course, the Science Center is open, and we will actually be giving out free solar eclipse glasses.
Yep.
So
it's like welder's kind of glasses, right?
They are, and it's very important you get the right ones, like any other major situation. Imitators come out, but this will be dangerous, right? We all know better than to look directly at the sun, or even at the sun when it's 85% covered. So the trick is that true eclipse glasses block out all light except for sunlight. So if you put them on and you look at, say, a light bulb, if you can see the light bulb, toss the glasses.
Yeah.
So that's how you can, and there's plenty of information on our website and in particular NASA's website. But should you not have your eclipse glasses undusted and out of the attic, grab an apple, come on down to the Science Center. I think this is a great reason to take a late lunch.
That was my next question, is when exactly is the eclipse?
The eclipse is from 1:03 p.m. to 3:47 p.m.
Wow,
yes.
That's long.
So it's a bit of time. Yeah, so that will be good. And really, we are encouraging folks to sort of come down, especially if you're in the downtown area, midtown area. But I feel like you should just be able to tell your boss, listen, the eclipse is about to happen. I'm going down to the Science Center indefinitely, wherever your kids are. Bring them on down to the Science Center. Or even if it's a cloudy day, we'll still be able to see it get dark. But of course, everyone who listens to your show knows that we opened our Toyota 4D Engineering Theater over Memorial Day weekend. But that is actually our distance learning epicenter as well. So we will be live broadcasting via NASA. So even if it's a cloudy day,
doesn't matter.
We will be the place to see the eclipse. And of course, if you know, if you got to choose between see it the real one, like right here in Detroit, or if you want to see totality, you can come on inside the Science Center, and we will be live streaming it from NASA in our 4D theater. It's going to be so cool.
Yeah, it'd be nice to see it. With your own eyes live, but we're not going to be able to do that. So if you want to see the real deal, right?
Then exactly. And it's a two-hour window, right? So you just come on in. You can look outside. You come on in, peek your head in the theater, and then go on back outside and back and forth and back and forth. So
are you going to encourage people to put those aluminum cone head things on and, no, huh?
I will potentially actively discourage the aluminum cone heads. M. Night Shyamalan have not warned us of anything else.
Okay,
that
so
will
no
be
aliens are going to be coming down or taking us away and all that jazz.
Not exactly. And I say that because we are tying the entire Science Center programming that day. So in our Spark Lab, we will actually be challenging folks to rebuild habitats on different ecosystems, so different planets and things like that. So if you really really do have dreams of going into the broader universe and living on other planets. We're going to have some challenges set up in Spark Lab. So this is going to be sub-freezing temperatures like we've never seen, never known. Planets that are closer to our sun as well as other suns and stars. So the Spark Lab is our partnership with the Smithsonian, and that is what we do. We do adventurous problem solving, and I think figuring out what your home has to look like if you live on a different planet is a pretty adventurous problem to solve.
So it's kind of like inviting the aliens to come down, right? So we're going to have your habitat. Come on down to the Science Center. Check it out.
That may be one, or maybe they're naturally competitive and they want to come down here and challenge some kids and some curious adults to how to build a planet on Jupiter competition. I'd be up for that. We could stream that too.
Yeah, they're probably building Earth habitats out there, right? Just for their kids to understand how them Earthlings do it. Right?
I think they'd probably be doing that. That's a very good point, Mike.
Yeah. Okay, so getting back to the top of your list, space, science, and fun. All this is STEM related: science, technology, engineering, math, and of course for we folks that were Bachelor of Arts folks, that would be arts as well, right?
It is. It's a STEM and whatever other letters I need. I've got a pocketbook full of acronyms. STEAM adds the arts. STREAM adds reading and the arts. And this weekend, someone introduced me to the concept of STELLA.
Stella,
which
it's like
was
Marlon Brando. I'm thinking of a streetcar named Desire. Stella.
Honestly, that's what I was thinking as well.
Oh, sorry, I just blasted Jessica's ears there.
Yeah, I think we just took out our sound.
Okay, sorry. She's okay though. I think she's on.
It was science, technology, engineering, literacy, and then doubling up on the L for another literacy and the arts. So again, we can, by every means necessary, we're going to bring our communities and our full country forward. And so that's, of course, the mission of the Science Center, all children, all communities. So we're doing some preview stuff as we lead up to the eclipse. Because, of course, we're having the eclipse the whole month. We're turning it over. We're going to be talking about space and the sun and the universe. So I mentioned that the 4D Theater is indeed our distance learning hub. So we launched the preliminary versions of those programs. Our distance learning program is now officially called ECHO, which I think is very cool. And so we're going to have our NGSS, Next Generation Science Standards, aligned programming and that kind of thing. So, but don't you worry, you'll have fun. We'll align it in the background. So one of our first events is, of course, we're going to be talking to some folks over at NASA. So we're going to be talking to Karma Snyder, which is an awesome, awesome name, on August 16th, right? So we've got some of our summer campers. And our members and folks can come and sign up and talk to a NASA project manager. She is actually down at the Stennis Space Center in Mississippi.
Oh,
so the nice thing about this is that we can go to folks and folks can come to us without leaving their own space. And she was the senior design engineer for the liquid rocket engine team for the Lunar Crater Observation.
Well, so she really is a rocket scientist.
She really is a rocket scientist. And so I don't exactly think she's coming to tell us it's not going to be that hard. But I think she will definitely tell us how and why it's possible. So we're really excited to test out our first official ECHO program. So that's going to be August the 16th. And, of course, you can get that information on our website.
And then you have Sunstruck.
We do. So Sunstruck is our planetarium show. It's actually one of my favorites, and not just because we actually created it here at the Michigan Science Center. So that was also in partnership with NASA. And so it's about the sun, the origins of the sun way back into time. It's got authentic satellite footage and digital puppetry all mixed up together to talk about the sun. So it's really good. The kids resonate because it's got kind of like the puppetry, and actually adults like it too because the sun is one of those things you think you know everything about it because you see it every day and you vaguely remember having to study it in the sixth grade. But some really cool and interesting things that are happening there. And so, of course, we're going to be featuring Sunstruck just days before the sun is going to be blocked out by our moon.
So lots of sunny programming in August.
Well, it's a good month for sunny programming. Sunny. Definitely. Mm-hmm, definitely.
All right. So I think we covered everything. Let's see. I'm glancing through the list quickly. So we're going to have to kibitz here for a while. Let's, how is attendance this summer? Are you drawing a lot of folks?
We're doing really well. And by far, the most popular thing actually is the 4D Engineering Theater. Folks are loving that fully immersive experience. Our show is on weather, extreme weather 4D. So see the hurricane, feel the hurricane, see the cow, smell the cow. The seventh graders get a bigger kick out of smelling the cow than I think the professors do. So that's been really, really cool. Plus, we just opened up the STEM playground, which we're hoping to continue. So it's designed exactly what you think. You know how sometimes you go to a playground, you can't decide what to try first, and it doesn't really all match. You just get to do different things. That's the way we've set that up. So right now we've got the Grand Paper Airplane Challenge. Mm. There is more than one way to fold yourself a paper airplane, Mike. I have learned that. Mm. And then we have rings at like 5, 10, and 20 feet. And you got to get your airplane through the rings. We also have a sailboat challenge to see if you can figure out how to navigate headwinds. And those different kinds of things. And so it gives us the opportunity to move things around. But those challenges will be with us through the summer while we come up with some ideas for more. Very cool.
We only got about 2 minutes left, so we can't talk about the fall unless you can do it really fast.
No, I don't want to talk fully about the fall, but I will have some grand news when I come back in September.
Okay.
We are putting the finishing touches on our fall exhibition. It is going to be, we're bringing an internationally touring exhibition to Detroit through the Science Center. So I'm very, very excited about that. Thus far, it's only been in LA, New York, and DC. So of course, it must come to Detroit.
You're going to break the news here, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Eat your heart out, Chicago.
But so if give us a little information about the Science Center, the address, how much it costs to get and all that jazz.
Absolutely. So you can check us out at www.mi-sci.org. This is the summertime. We are open 7 days a week. We close at 5 p.m. during the week and 6 p.m. on the weekends. And we have all different kinds of packages depending on how much you want to see. Take some time. We've got 5 theater spaces inside the Science Center, and people do spend a really cool day there. And also during the fall, we'll be combining some member nights with our neighbors. So come one, come all.
Now, on the eclipse night, might you run a little longer than 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, whatever
it is? Well, the eclipse actually ends at 3:47, so we think folks will be done by then. But, you know, we have yet to really kick people out. Mm. So if folks show up at 3:42 to catch the edge of the eclipse, we can have a conversation.
Okay. We're going to have to leave it at that. That's Dr. Tanya Matthews, the CEO and so many other titles of the Michigan Science Center. And you've been listening to M Squared TechCast on the Podcast Detroit Network. It's Mike Brennan. We're back on another one of our segments on M Squared TechCast on the Podcast Detroit Network. And we're doing the Tech 248 segment. And we have Greg Doyle, who has joined us today. How you doing, Greg?
Good afternoon. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, yeah, great. Actually, I was talking to the other Greg, Melling, because he got here early, so we were chit-chatting. I had not heard of MacuVision. Is that pronounced?
That's correct.
I've not heard of it before, but I'm very intrigued to find out more. So I'm going to turn this over to you and drain all the information
out of them. All right. So you're in for a treat because this is one of the coolest companies in Oakland County. And we're really proud to have them here, actually in Troy, right?
Yes.
So tell us, Greg, tell us a little bit about what does the company do?
Sure. Thanks for having us. It's great to be a part of the show here. At a high level, you know, MacuVision, we are North American headquarters is based here in Oakland County. We are a content creation company focused on creating digitally produced content. We have here locally about 130 artists. We focus on a lot of automotive and consumer-based solutions, but we have a combination of two parts of our business, which one is the creative and artistic business, and another part of the business is our content platform. So we have a content generation and fulfillment platform that a lot of the automotive companies here, the OEMs in town, actually use. And yeah, it's a pretty exciting space for us. We also have a visual effects arm of our company that is currently doing the Game of Thrones visual effects for that show. We also do other programs for Netflix and some of these other ones, HBO and what have you.
So who would have thought all that cool stuff was being done right here?
Yeah,
can I leap in at this point?
Sure.
How did you guys get plugged into these mega shows like that? How did that all work out?
We actually have a visual effects group in Hamburg, Germany, which is part of our company. And we have some award-winning talent that comes out of the visual effects industry that has these individuals, they have big names in a lot of the feature films out there. And having that level of talent allows us to have collaborations with the folks at HBO and some of these other companies that, you know, where that work comes from, I'll say.
Who would have thunk it, huh?
Yeah, it's amazing. So, you know, you were talking about content. And I'm assuming that means content for social media, content for web, you know. There's been so much happening out there. And I think there's a level of confusion in the market around, like, what? All these channels. What do I do? How do I manage that? Is that something that you guys help with?
Sure. Actually, that is a great question. You know, we are a company that is really focused on content. You know, we focus on creating highly realistic content. Actually, our motto is creating realism in a world that is indistinguishable. And so the question around content fulfillment and creation and delivery across all of the channels that a typical, we'll say, manufacturer is faced with today can be pretty daunting, right? The expansion of social media, a lot of the more experiential type forums, and then, of course, you have all the traditional forms, right? Print and the broadcast and the web and these things. And so we are very focused on helping our customers properly address the content needs of all of those different platforms. And actually, that's what our solution, the MacuVision Content Fulfillment Platform, really focuses on is being able to optimize the creative work and deliver that artistic content across that breadth of media outlet.
So depending on the company or the industry, I imagine there's so many channels that your mm-hmm. recommendation changes on that, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's a good point. If you look at how things have changed, you actually have more content needed today within the same marketing spend. That's a typical example. And so the challenge is Companies are saying, you know, we can't afford to dramatically increase the amount of money we're spending to create content out there and experiences on top of it. And so the goal is to say, you know, through a very well-planned, comprehensive creative exercise, you can actually deliver a wide range of content that fits all of those downstream needs. And that's really, you know, where the opportunity is for large companies today is to do more, to deliver more, and without, you know, completely ballooning the amount of money that's being spent to do so.
Hmm. Wow. So you're talking about OEMs and the automotive, but you service even beyond that. What industries are we talking about here that you provide services to?
Right now, I would say the large majority of our work is with the automotive industry. You know, we do a lot of work also in film and entertainment, of course. A smaller part of our business is focused on consumer, the broader transportation, heavy equipment, and these types of things. A lot of, again, what we do, because we're working from digital CAD data, where you have the high cost of prototyping and photography before products are released to market, that's where the opportunity to work digitally has a very high value point. And so what we're doing now is we've been able to create a pretty compelling solution out there for the transportation business. But now in areas like consumables and we'll say aircraft and other areas like that, it's becoming equally as compelling.
What I've heard is that a lot of the commercials we see on TV for automobiles are really all digital, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's no longer a nice pretty car and a nice pretty setting. It's all computers, right?
Yep. It's getting to be more so. So right now, I would say the television, the commercials you see today is a combination of probably about 50% practically shot and about 50% digitally. What we're doing is we're doing both. We're actually taking television commercials that customers or our OEM customers have shot sometimes 1, 2, or 3 years ago, and we're doing digital replacements of putting new cars in old commercials.
Really?
That's something that we specialize in, and we do it pretty well. And so what we're finding is, you know, there is a move from, you know, creating those commercial spots and that photography traditionally to sort of a combined application where we're doing digital replacements. But also the cost of the digital production can, you know, is low enough to make it, you know, more and more frequent that we're actually doing complete digital, you know, television commercials and spots like CGI.
Huh.
That's great. You know, that just brings to mind this kind of maybe newer area of virtual reality affecting your industry and your customers and so on. How are you working in that area?
Yep. That is probably one of the most frequently asked questions, because right now there has been more and more of a shift from just traditional content to experience. And, you know, we all are familiar with the head-mounted devices that are coming out for virtual reality, augmented reality, and what have you. And so because we do digital production, you know, that's a very easy fit for us. We can expand our production pipelines to accommodate, you know, more experiential content. And again, building the experiential content with a cohesive plan where traditional content and social and these other things are being planned as part of that one creative experience, it allows us to be very efficient in the way we deliver it. But I will say, you know, augmented reality, virtual reality, mixed reality, all these areas, it's an opportunity for you to engage those audiences in a much more fascinating and much more intimate way. And so those experiences are really being moved more and more towards those social events, high touch, PR type things like that.
Well, what I'm hearing is augmented reality is going to be much, much bigger than virtual reality. Do you agree?
Yeah, right now the spend, I will say investment in augmented reality is probably about 80% of the market. Mm-hmm. And, you know, augmented reality provides a perfect mechanism to place information in the context of reality. Mm-hmm. And so it also one other really important part is that with augmented reality, typically you're able to allow somebody to interact in a safe and responsible way with their environment versus a complete virtual reality environment. When people put on the virtual reality headsets, they're
no longer in contact with the real world.
Exactly. Yes, and right. So they might run into things and yes. knock things over and what have you. So augmented reality has been a little safer bet.
And the classic example last summer, Pokemon Go. Exactly. Flash in the pan, 50 million users and kind of went away. But
yeah,
really absolutely. Demonstrated the power of augmented reality.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep. We've been following on that. You know, Pokemon Go is a perfect example. You know, even my kids knew about augmented reality and, you know, just to show the power of the platform, you know, they derived over $1 billion of ad revenue out of that free application in a matter of a few months. So there's a lot of power there.
Wow. So what do you kind of see as a future? And we've got maybe a couple minutes here to talk about
sure.
what you see for the company.
Yep. So, you know, the future, that's a great question. You know, I think our customers look to us to help them understand what the future is. And I think, you know, from my standpoint and the leadership within MacuVision, we really believe that, you know, you have to follow the consumption model. And so we have a younger generation of very digitally connected folks. And we have a lot of investments going into I'll say another plane of reality, right? And we have, you know, we just talked about the augmented reality space. There's so much investments going in that space. And I think we need to envision a future and understand there is a future where our, where the media and content is going to live around us all the time. And how we consume and prepare and live in that space is going to be very exciting.
Take us out, Greg.
Well, that's fantastic. It's just, you know, a great example of another wonderful tech company in Oakland County that we're really proud to have you in Oakland County and Troy, and wish you all the best for the future. Tech 248 is definitely a home for you to network in, and we're looking forward to the rest of this year.
Should have an event at your place, right? Are you going to do that?
That would be great. We've already started talking about that today. So thanks so much for letting us be part of this today.
All right. That's
awesome.
That's Greg Melling and Greg Doyle. Greg Melling is with MacuVision and Greg Doyle with Tech 248. And you've been listening to M Squared TechCast on the Podcast Detroit Network. Mike Brennan, we're back with the final segment on M Squared TechCast on the Podcast Detroit Network. And I have not met Mike before, but I know his partner in crime, Amanda Luan, quite well. Mike, I'm going to try to pronounce this correctly, Ferlito?
That was perfect.
All right, good. And he is the partner with Amanda, who I think is the hardest working millennial I know. But I looked at your picture, and I'm guessing you're probably a millennial as well, right?
That would be correct.
Okay, good. All right, so I'm pretty familiar with what you're doing. I talked to Amanda about it, but let's talk to you about it now. You come from the real estate side. I wasn't that familiar with your company. I looked at it over the weekend just to bring myself up to speed. And this is a family-owned real estate company? Is that what it is?
Yes, that's exactly what it is.
Okay. And so give me the backstory. How did you get involved? Because I'll get to the news here shortly, but I'm more interested in how did you get hooked up with Amanda? How did that all take place?
So that story coincides with how, you know, Bamboo got started. My background, family background, construction, real estate development, property management. I started out in 2010. My dad started the business in 1980. So as soon as I got out of college, I went along with him. I started working for him. And a couple of years later, I wanted to diversify into technology and into just other spaces other than construction. It was still very slow for construction and development. Not a lot going on. So fast forward to 2013, I met two of the original partners, Brian Davis and David Anderson, actually downtown. And they had these great ideas, and they wanted to start a co-working space. So I'm like, all right, let's do it. What the heck is a co-working space? My father actually had a piece of property in downtown on Brush Street, and the second floor of that building was vacant. So they go, let's put it in your dad's building. I'm like, all right. So I pitched the idea to my dad. He's like, all right, what the heck's co-working space? 3 months later, we were open for business. Amanda came on as a social media writer and kind of like the marketing arm of our team. Fast forward that, a year later, we brought her on as a full-fledged partner in the business of equal value. And it's been a roller coaster ever since.
Yeah, and now you've moved to the Julian C. Madison Building in downtown Detroit, staying in downtown Detroit. And that was, what, 6 months ago, a year ago? I'm trying to remember exactly when that was.
Yeah, 7 months ago now.
Okay, yeah. Because I was at the party. There must have been 300 or 400 people there on the launch party. But even beyond that, now you've leased 3,000 square feet on the fourth floor of the Julian C. Madison Building because you're, what, growing so fast?
I wouldn't say it's Bamboo growing so fast. I would say it's we're just filling a need. I mean, there is such a huge need in the city and really in the country for affordable space for small teams. And, as the economy changes and big box offices get chopped up and people don't want to work the 9-to-5s anymore, the need for affordable office space within the community is going to grow.
Okay, and then the fourth floor, is that going to be bigger offices? Is that going to be set up any differently from the third floor?
So the third floor has a couple different varieties of membership level. The fourth floor is only going to be office space, and those office spaces range from 2 to 10-man teams in the variety of offices. And the fourth floor is already 50% leased, thanks to Amanda. Hard work and her dedication to the business. So we hope to be 100% leased by the time we open, which will be probably mid-September.
Mid-September. Wow, that's moving right along.
Yes.
So, all right. In fact, as a disclaimer, I've worked out an arrangement with Amanda. So when I come in into town on Mondays, I will be joining Bamboo Detroit with one of those memberships that allows me to drop in and use different facilities because I really want to get a chance to get to know a lot of the companies that you have there. So perhaps we'll cross paths. I don't know if you're there during the day or that's Amanda's thing.
Yeah, I'm usually there every day, and we appreciate your support and welcome you into the community. You know, it's changed so much from December of 2016 to August of 2017, just the amount of new membership coming in, the diversity of not only the demographic of people, but the diversity of types of businesses, size of businesses, nonprofits. I mean, literally everything I purchase and other businesses I buy out of Bamboo, design, website development, to PR, it's just, you're really going to enjoy your time there.
Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, let's go into what you offer entrepreneurs, particularly those that are just starting out, maybe a one-person, you know, one-man, one-woman kind of operation. What do you offer them?
So the best thing for them, in my opinion, is to jump into open co-working. And open co-working is basically what the membership you are speaking of. It's all access pass. You get to use the space whenever you'd like. All printing's included. Coffee's included. Rocket Fiber's included. Mail services and mailing address, all included in your membership. The reason why I say open co-working is because you get to sit in the community and you really get to engage and talk with people. People are part of this community because they want to engage with you as well. So the networking is – the barrier to networking is very low. Also, our events and workshops. The reason – I personally think this. The reason why Bamboo grew, you know, so fast and so strong, our motto, is when we first started out, we just did events. We had speaker series, or series, fireside chats, workshops – to engage the community that we're in. So as an entrepreneur, come to the events, definitely purchase the workshops. We hire professionals from inside and outside of the space to actually teach technical training of what they're speaking of. So there is just a variety of things that that just the Open Co-working membership offers.
And then if you add a few members to your team, what do you offer that level?
So we also have a membership level called Dedicated Desk, and that allows you to have storage, your own private desk. The amenities are pretty much the same, but it allows you your own dedicated space. If you need more private space for a 2 to 4 to 5 to 6, 7-man team, then we definitely offer the private office spaces. And why those really have the highest demand is because Bamboo pretty much signs on all of the amenities and utilities, furniture, and construction costs you have to do yourself if you're going into a traditional office space.
Yeah. All right. And then as we know, you even have, if somebody wants their own dedicated office, they'll now have that on the fourth floor, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So, you know, you're expanding now. You're just making this move, but... how big can the footprint grow? I mean, after you do the fourth floor, is that pretty much it for that building, or is there more space, or what?
There is more space. We weren't expecting to grow into the fourth floor this year, but the demand was just so high, and the reaction from the community was so positive that we just didn't have a choice. So this will grow to about 10,000 square feet. The model that we're trying to push regionally and nationally is about a 15,000 square foot office space. We feel that is the right amount of space for the density and the size market that Detroit's currently in. So there is vacancy in the Julian C. Madison building. I know Sharon Madison is trying to lease the remaining portions of her building, which her building's leasing up pretty quick here. So we definitely have enough room to grow from the 10,000 square foot floor print into a larger floor print.
So I'm astounded. I came back from the West Coast. I was in Seattle. I took a job with the Detroit Free Press in the mid 90s, and downtown Detroit, not such a good place. I'm amazed over a little over 20 years how much that's changed. How about you? You're younger than me, but you're familiar with Detroit. You saw where we were and where we are now. Does it surprise you?
I don't think it surprises me. The past 5 years definitely is I think internationally people are extremely impressed on the speed that at least the 7.2 has come back from, you know, desertion over the past 40 years. My family has been investing in developing the city since probably the late, 1980s really in the greater city, but downtown since the late 90s, our largest project being the Kales Building, the redevelopment there. So we've seen it firsthand. Obviously, I believe the comeback would have came a lot faster if we didn't have the Great Recession that just clobbered 99% of the developers that I know, and just, you know, the city in general because of the automotive businesses. But, you know, it's just it's due. It's, you know, I keep telling everyone this is a post-industrial-sized city, and, you know, rates are, you know, climbing to a place where they should be. You know, I'm a developer, so I'm also developing, you know, a mixed-use project in Midtown. We're selling condos for $400 a foot.
Wow.
Yeah.
That would be the next thing is I'm told, I live in Ann Arbor, but that's a very expensive market, but I'm told that downtown Detroit is there's just not enough apartments available. How do you solve that problem? Just keep building them, I guess?
You know, it's very difficult downtown because there's just not a lot of properties you can scale a large development. I know there's a lot going on, you know, in Midtown and in the district. And there is a lot of demand. I mean, you have people, half the buyers in our project, it's called the Selden. Half the buyers came from Royal Oak.
Really?
You know, so, you know, we're not really pulling from, you know, interstate communities. It's coming from other urban communities. And, you know, the millennials, the older millennials are really driving the forces and the purchases. But there's just not a lot of supply. That's the basis. That's the basic premise of the issue. And I know developers are racing, but, you know, it's just, you know, you run into such a twofold issue. I mean, there's so much supply, or there's so much demand, but construction costs are increasing at 20% per year.
Wow.
On the heavy stuff. So, you know, as long as we keep going forward and just try to get more shovels in the ground, cutting the red tape that the administration is trying to do in terms of making it easier for developers and businesses to build, you're going to start seeing more supply in the market. Now, in the office rates are $20 to $35 a square foot.
Huh.
All the new stuff Dan Gilbert's doing is $45 to
$60.
Ooh. So office has a lot of room for rent appreciation, and that's why a shared office model like Bamboo has it just makes the most sense for small businesses.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got about 2 minutes left. Where do you see the future of this all going? Not necessarily Bamboo, but just downtown Detroit, or you can even talk about the future of Bamboo. I know you were saying you'd eventually like to get to 15,000 square feet.
Yeah, so the future of Bamboo, as soon as we're done building out the Detroit space, our goal is to go to Ann Arbor next. And then some of the Rust Belt urban communities, we want to have about 8 stores in about 5 years.
Hmm.
That's the goal. That's the future for Bamboo. The city of Detroit, if everyone just keeps working together, remembering that businesses and communities need to be inclusive and everyone needs to raise each other up and stop with this two Detroits thing, even though, you know, it is a very real conversation. And we just need to all keep going forward and pressing forward. And, you know, there's just so much work to do. There's not enough people to do it. If you just keep your head down, keep working hard, you know, the city is going to make quite the comeback. And it's, I would say, it's, you know, one out of 10, it's at the second stage. So it's just so much room to grow. And it's not too late to come down to the city. It's not too late to invest in property. It's not too late. So, the city should look completely different in the next 5 years, in my opinion.
Hopefully for the better.
Yep, hopefully for the better.
Okay,
right.
Yes. Mike Ferlito, co-founder of Bamboo Detroit, talking about the expansion in that facility and the Julian C. Madison building right downtown. Been there a couple times myself. And so we want to thank you for being on the show. We also want to thank Norbert Kugler from Warner Norcross and Judd, Tanya Matthews from the Michigan Science Center, Greg Doyle from Tech 248, and Matt Rouse is out there somewhere playing golf, so good luck to him. Hopefully he's going to hit par. We don't know. But in the meantime, we'll be back next week. This is Mike Brennan, and you've been listening to M Squared TechCast on the Podcast Detroit Network.
Thanks for listening to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Join your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan, next Monday at 3 p.m. If you can't listen live, audio podcasts of the show can be found at podcastdetroit.com.